Hello, everybody. This is Glumpuddle, our first live news podcast. We're excited.
And this is Rillian.
How are you doing, Rillian?
I'm doing well.
Yeah, I'm sure your life has been pretty quiet, as I understand it, so not much to talk about.
Very quiet. Very quiet.
Definitely.
Other than when baby Rillian is awake and
baby Rillian awake. Cool.
He is now 9 days old.
Right. Okay. So,
and Mrs. Rillian is doing fabulous.
Okay. So much going on these days, having babies. And oh, yeah, there's some Narnia news. Let's get to the real exciting stuff, actually. I'm kidding, of course.
Hurtful.
Anyway, so we're Facebook Living this for the first time, which is really cool. We did do the commentary on Saturday, which was really fun. But now we're doing our first live news podcast. So usually I can't edit out all the stupid stuff that we usually say. So we'll see how all this goes. Anyway, so
you'll now see exactly how stupid we really are.
Yeah, you get to see the real us. So let's just go ahead and do this and see what happens then. So really, why don't you go ahead and summarize today's or this morning's news, really?
Oh, yeah, it was this morning's news, and I got I was not on the ball, so I got a text later from Glumpuddle, and basically, Douglas Gresham was at an event, and one of our Narnia Web spies, Hogglestock, was there, and basically gave us a rundown. Gresham thinks that pre-production on the Silver Chair will begin early next year, 2017.
Woo!
And for those who don't know, pre-production is basically, you think about back when you see the making of videos kind of start to come in, stuff like they'll starting to work on concept art, they're starting to work on, or even like finalized concept art, costuming, scouting locations. Basically, it's all the stuff that has to happen before you can actually begin filming. So just think about all the stuff that has to happen with all the people in the background before you begin filming. That's what he's saying could actually start, he thinks, early next year. He also said that regarding Puddleglum's famous speech from Chapter 12, where he's talking to the Lady of the Green Kirtle, Gresham says, "We've got that in the movie."
Woo!
Yes, and which is important. Very important, of course, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. But
and Trisha's excited about that, apparently. Woo! Yay!
And also, here, and this is almost, to me, more the most important part of this. It sounds kind of boring, but I think it's actually the most important. He says that TriStar has been completely on board with Gresham's wishes for the script. He called The Silver Chair the best Narnia movie script we have ever had and believes it will be a corker of a movie. I don't know what corker means.
If you scroll down on the comments, let me actually do that right now. You scroll down to Rose Tree Dryad, learned what corker means. And where is it? It means someone or something that is astonishing or excellent.
There we go.
Thank you, Rose Tree Dryad.
Appreciate it. So basically, he says, yeah, it's going to be a great movie. He says that, and as of now, we still have David McGee as the only announced screenwriter. And that's basically it. So we kind of have basically the big things we're kind of wondering about. First of all, is it accurate that it'll start in 2017, early 2017, actually?
That's the current plan, anyway.
Yep. And then if that is the current plan, then when would filming start? Maybe 2018. When would filming end? And when would the film be released? And how would the budget impact all this?
Right.
And again, what are the, pros and cons of... Because it sounds like, that Gresham is getting a lot of what he wants with the script. But here, actually, maybe this is a better way of putting it. It sounds like he's not having to fight TriStar.
Yeah.
Might be a better way to put it. It doesn't sound like they're having a lot of conflicts on their vision.
Not at this stage, anyway.
At this stage, no. So what are the pros and cons for that? And Glumpuddle, I want to hear your thoughts.
Okay. So as far as the whole thing with Gresham, the pros and cons of Gresham wanting a lot of control, it's perfectly natural for him to do that. I don't envy the position that Douglas Gresham is in, where he kind of has, he's kind of the temporary custodian of the whole Narnia franchise, or the Chronicles of Narnia as a whole. Obviously feeling very protective of it. At the same time, it's such a difficult line, because if you're too protective, if you're too restrictive and not letting kind of creative people, artists, do what they want to do, and sometimes creative people have ideas that they may sound weird, but they have the vision in their head. You know, when George Lucas was pitching Star Wars, they thought the idea of having like a big dog as a co-pilot was super weird, but him, a creative, an artist, could in his head see, no, I think this could actually be cool. So that's kind of the downside of when you have and Gresham's not necessarily a creative, necessarily a storyteller, mm-hmm. an artist. So that's kind of the downside of having someone who wants a lot of control. But at the same time, it is good to have somewhere who, you know, has obviously lived and breathed C.S. Lewis and Narnia as much or more than any of us. Sure. Kind of having that guiding hand. And I actually think that Andrew Adamson was a pretty good match for Gresham in terms of you get the sense that there was some compromise and there was some of Adamson saying, no, I really think we should do this with the film and we need both of those. So I really think there's pros and cons, but I don't envy Douglas Gresham's position of having to be the guardian of something that means a lot to so many people.
Exactly. And I want to quote one of the most insightful things I ever heard from a film commentator. His name is Brian Carnell. He said, you know, if you have a good book and you're going to make a movie adaptation, then it's not, first of all, one of the essential ingredients among many is going to be that the film is a good movie. Because if it's a good book and you're adapting it into a movie, if it's not a good movie, then it's not a good adaptation, whatever else you have. I'm paraphrasing you, but
yeah, I think that sounds better actually.
But basically, and I hadn't really thought of it in that way before, but I agree. I think that the film as a film medium has to work. And if it's not going to work, then doesn't matter what else you have. It's not going to. And I think that's part of the problem with, I think we've talked about like the old BBC Narnia films. And obviously The Silver Chair was the most, I think, faithful adaptation in terms of just capturing the book's image. And it was also the best of the movies, I think, in terms of overall quality.
And part of that was they didn't have to deal with talking animals very much in The Silver
Exactly.
Chair.
So I think that, you know, that's, yeah, there does have to be balance. And I just don't know enough about Gresham in terms of what type of creative mind he has. I think he seems to have a decent understanding of how much, you know, how a film does have to work as a film.
Yeah.
And I do know, without going into too much detail, I will say I do have some pretty reliable knowledge on the insight into the Silver Chair, sorry, not Silver Chair, the Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
Mm-hmm.
And I do know that there were certain battles that Gresham won on things that he thought were important, but basically the give and take was so hard that
to win
a few, he had to give up on a bunch of others. And basically, I think he was just really, I think the studio did not understand his vision, didn't want to work with him very much. And I think that that's partly why, you know, there were certain things he was able to keep in the film, but when they were pulling so hard the other direction, it just wasn't going to happen. And it doesn't sound like that's happening here.
Yeah, it's cool. It's obviously, at this stage, at least, it's good that they're happy in the script phase. And I agree with Austin. Thanks for your comment. I agree with Austin about The Silver Chair being a more natural story in terms of film. You know, it's with Caspian, I think more so with Caspian, but also with Dawn Treader, it was what are they going to do to really make this work as a movie? With Silver Chair, there are some problems we'll talk about in the coming years, but it's definitely a little more, it lends itself to film, at least right off the bat, a little more naturally. So yeah, I'm obviously excited about that. As far as the timelines for the movie, which our own Fantasia Kitty years ago put together a handy little list that I've linked mm-hmm. in the story, comparing or sort of documenting timelines of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, at least, and Prince Caspian, the post below that. So basically, we're assuming that if pre-production begins, say, early next year, then we'd suppose it lasts about a year, just guessing from that, of course. And then if it lasts about a year, so let's say filming begins early 2018, then maybe filming ends in the summer of 2018, then maybe you have a year of post-production that would give it about a summer 2019 release, or maybe a little earlier. You've been seeing a lot of big movies coming out in March these days, especially lower-budget movies, which The Silver Chair might be. But also, if it's a lower-budget movie, that tends to compress the timeline somewhat. Maybe they have less money to have a long, long shooting schedule or a lot of post-production, and so that tends to compress things a bit. So I think it's possible we could see something maybe as early as late 2018, potentially.
Now, here's a question, Glenville. You would know more about this than I would. So, obviously, whenever we get news about the director, and I say when, I'm pretty optimistic about this movie being made. I really am becoming more and more optimistic.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think we all are.
So I really think it's going to be a win. When we get the director announced, there's going to be this feeling of, oh, yes, it's moving forward. But let's not forget, Andrew Adamson was announced as the director 3.5 years before Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. What is the fastest turnaround you've ever heard of or know of for a director being announced and production starting on a movie?
Probably Peter Jackson in The Hobbit, actually.
Which is kind of weird because, again, they had a director before Peter Jackson who was doing a lot of work for him. I mean, he was doing a lot of that stuff that needed to be done.
Yeah, off the top of my head, that's what comes to mind. I know that Ant-Man had Edgar Wright for a while, and then not long before production started, they went with somebody else, probably, unfortunately. But it is true. So Andrew Adams, I don't know how great of a comparison Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is. I really don't. That was I think there was so
what
much
was the first one.
Yeah,
and they're continuing so much of the concept art. They'll probably try to go with Weta again.
Maybe I don't know with this. I think this may be something very, very different. It's a totally different creative team. It really is. When we talk about The Silver Chair as a reboot, that's the sense that I agree that it's a reboot. That they really are from the ground up getting a new crew. Probably getting an all new cast, just kind of like it really is building up that foundation again. And when Gresham talks about pre-production, it's also that's why in the story I said pre-production usually refers to, because it's a fairly loose term. It could just mean that's where we're going to start getting a director and getting more development. It could not necessarily mean what I usually take it to mean of actually building sets and scouting locations, casting actors, designing costumes, all that stuff.
And again, I think that pre-production does vary so much. I remember seeing a video of Peter Jackson going over concept art for The Lord of the Rings, and he had some models and stuff. And I think it was filmed in 1995.
Yeah.
Again, it really does depend. It's just, and it might be a much easier. If it's a smaller scale film, it's almost like when I say smaller scale, really in terms of pre-production, a lot of it, there'd probably be more attention to shooting locations than maybe a lot of others, but there's probably not going to be nearly as much time and money and energy spent on sets just because their landscape is so much of the set in The Silver Chair.
Yeah. Okay. That is true, and it's hard to say what would be cheaper to do. Am I thinking, is this going to be a mostly locations movie, or is it mostly going to be sound stages? It just depends. That's kind of difficult to say. I would think it probably mostly one or the other, I would think. I've talked about before how a lower-budget Narnia movie has its, especially if Gresham wants to retain control, keep getting as few cooks in the kitchen as possible who are trying to protect their investment. You got to keep that budget as low as possible if you want that.
Do you think, in terms of Gresham having control over the script, do you think that do you think that Prince Caspian or The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was a film where Gresham probably had more control over the script? Or let me put it this way, maybe that is a good way to put it. Had more control, or maybe got more of his wish list items in.
Well, I get the sense he was overall happier with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, definitely. Obviously the most famous one, the Suspian thing, Gresham called that nonsense later. And so I can think of like a couple things in Prince Caspian that I don't know if he regretted it, he had to make some compromises there. But I think it didn't hurt as much because he really knew that, Prince Caspian's, we all did, difficult book to adapt. There were some complications there. So he was a little more ready for it. And actually, it was Reepicheep 775 in the comments section that observed that Gresham wasn't exactly falling all over himself trying to promote Dawn Treader in the way that he was with the first two movies. And I think I'd kind of thought about that, but not really until I read that comment, realized that's true. We didn't see as much of him when Dawn Treader was coming out. So definitely you feel like there were some things in Caspian that hurt him, but Dawn Treader really hurt him, is the sense I get.
Here's a question. I hope I'm not butchering the name. James Montalto.
Hey, James.
Montalto. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. He's asking if they'll return to New Zealand for filming. I really think that they, in my opinion, I think they're just as likely to return to New Zealand as pick any other new location.
I honestly don't know. I think one of the attractive things about New Zealand to Lord of the Rings, for example, was it was relatively inexpensive to film in. Now that a whole more kind of an industry has grown up around Lord of the Rings in New Zealand, I don't know if that is still the case or not.
And here's part of the thing. And like, yes, and like my grandparents have traveled to probably 35 some countries, and they say, you know, their two favorite, most beautiful countries they've been to are New Zealand and Croatia. Uh-huh. And so, sure, it's, you know, got a lot of beautiful landscape. I think one thing we have to recognize with New Zealand, with Lord of the Rings, is it had a great, it wasn't just beautiful landscapes, it was diversity of landscapes.
Yeah.
In a very geographically small area. You have Mount Ruapehu, you had desert areas, you had, you know, these, you had forests. So really, it was logistically godsend for them, basically,
yeah,
to have all that in a very, yeah, the North and South Island, uh-huh, basically. You know, I could see them trying to film the entire movie in Canada, uh-huh, or even in Ireland, and maybe they could probably feel like they have all the geography they need.
Yeah,
so I don't know.
I will say, as far as budget, the third act of this movie, darkness is pretty cheap. So we would probably expect most of the third act of the movie just to be filmed in sound stages. And I hope the budget forces them to, I guess we should move on, but get trying to run away here. But I hope it forces them to be more creative with how they do the darkness and not, and actually embrace the fact that maybe it's just black all around them for the most part. And we just see points of light and we hear the world a lot more than we see it. Let's embrace that. Where I think it was a disappointment, mm-hmm, in Dawn Treader with Dark Island, where they tried so much to firmly give us images rather than leaving. I think they should have left more to our imagination. What we imagine and what we can hear but can't see is usually a lot scarier than whatever scary, mm-hmm, monster you can come up with.
Yeah. Well, you know, and really quick, like just a really great example of a film. I don't know what the budget was for Kenneth Branagh's Henry V.
Uh-huh.
It was not an enormous budget, I don't think. But if you look at how he accomplished trying to portray thousands and thousands of French cavalry without showing,
uh-huh,
those numbers, he uses emotion and acting to accomplish what the budget couldn't.
And I wonder, I haven't seen that, but I wonder if the result is actually, I wonder if it's actually better than if he had had the resources to get thousands on screen.
You know, I'll put it this way. Me being a film kind of analyzer, I'm always the analyst when I'm watching films and stuff. And I'm watching it. To me, it was obvious, at least in the back of my mind, okay, you know what? Yes, I think that he was constrained by the budget here. But it made the scene with the French, you can probably find it on YouTube, with the French charging towards the English ranks, it made it so much more memorable. Because if he had done it maybe a traditional way with a big budget, it would just be one more cavalry charge.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it would be. It wouldn't really be anything that stands out in your memory. So it does stand out in memory more because he had to be more creative.
Right. So there's a lot obvious about the Silver Chair we don't know at this point, which is about 99.9%. But there's at least one thing that we do know, Rillian. What's that?
99.7.
Okay, 0.7.
We know a little more.
Okay, that's true. We know that, or at least we're pretty sure the main character is going to be Jill and Eustace, and we know Puddleglum's in it, so we know the title. We assume Lady the Green Curtle has a name, so okay, we know a little bit.
Here's one thing.
But we have at least one scene that we do know is in there.
That's true. And here's one thing I'm going to throw out real quick, why I think this is encouraging news. Every time you think about our biggest complaints about, which maybe this is the same with almost every book adaptation, not necessarily the BBC versions, ironically, but the biggest complaints we tend to have with the Narnia movies really is with the script.
Yes.
And it's, I mean, obviously you don't really know the script until, you know, much later, maybe really almost when you watch the film. But so again, this is why I'm encouraged by this news, because the thing that I'm most concerned about, which turned out to be my biggest frustration with Silverchair, was the script.
Yeah. Oh, you mean your frustration with Dawn Treader, you mean?
Sorry, yes. I keep saying that. That's okay. Every time I say, okay, going forward. Every
well,
time
I think that's probably true.
Some other Narnia movie that makes sense.
I mean, pretty much I feel that way about probably all the Narnia movies, that the script was at least the weak point. And I was actually thinking about that when I rewatched Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe for its 11th anniversary last weekend. And that there's a lot of the, like with all the scenes with Tumnus and Lucy, I think on the page, I don't think there's anything there. I've actually read that script, part of the script, and there's nothing, and this is true to some extent with screenplays in general, but I really think there's not much there. It's what James and Georgie really brought to it that really made it special. And I think that the first two, in my opinion, you know, like, well, we've had a mixture of sort of serviceable scripts, and it's fine to get the job done. And then some that are just lacking kind of from the get-go. And I won't say which I think is which. Yeah, it's cool. And Gresham seems really confident. He says, this is the best Narnia script yet. And it's going to be a corker of a movie. So if we can – and it's cool. Yeah, they're working with David McGee, the screenwriter, is by far the biggest name we've had attached to screenwriting yet. So that's exciting. I personally – this is not a shock, but it's pretty cool to see it confirmed – so soon that a Puddleglum speech from chapter 12 of The Silver Chair, that's after he stamps out the fire. I don't know if the actual stamping out of the fire will be in the movie or how that'll work, but right. Is at least going to be in the movie.
Well, and at least the other thing is, I think that so much of that speech includes the philosophy of so much of the book and of C.S. Lewis. And so I think that that's why it's big encouragement. And it's also interesting, the script is, however finalized it is, because we don't know, we've never had a good idea really on how finished it is. And of course it could be like a lot of other scripts where they're rewriting it daily as filming continues. Yeah.
And they may add more screenwriters.
Yeah, exactly. So there's that. And then, but that being said, it's finalized enough that he is confident saying, yeah, it'll be in the movie. Whatever else will change, that'll be in the movie.
Yeah. And the fact that he thinks that we're probably going to start pre-production next year and he knows that that's going to be in the movie. Yeah. That tells you that it's at a certain point now.
Exactly. Well, here's the other thing that's encouraging. He's saying pre-production will start early. He's not just saying next year.
It might start early.
Yeah, well, he's...
Yeah, that's the current plan.
He thinks, pre-production will start early next year. So that's at least more encouraging than sometime next year.
Exactly, that's true. That tells you that he feels like it's imminent.
Exactly.
So rather than just, oh yeah, you know, I call all time soon, you know. Other than throwing out one of those.
I call. Yeah. You do not want to hear from the director or producer.
But yeah, this is, like you said, about a lot of the philosophy of the book and C.S. Lewis in general. And I think it's one of those things that, there's a lot of discussion about what does Puddleglum mean when he talks about, in the book, about, well, suppose we have imagined all this, then it seems like this world that a bunch of babies created is a lot better than this world where there is no sun and the sun is the lamp and, you know, the cat is the real thing and all that. And I might as well live like a Narnian even if there isn't any Narnia. And
it's very interesting. There's a lot of philosophy in that speech.
Yeah, and I think it could easily – this is just my opinion. Like, anyone in the comments, please post if you disagree with me. But I don't think it's – if you look at it in context with the rest of the series, I don't see it as simple – as some way some people kind of read it initially, which is Puddleglum saying, well, I'm just basically going to believe in whatever makes me happy because it makes me happy. I might as well just believe in that because your world is boring. And I don't think it's that simple. I think it's more, okay, that seems to be true, but what does that give us a clue about? A lot of the themes of longing and the fact that having a desire for something, and maybe that indicates it's actually there. That's obviously in a lot of C.S. Lewis's work. But what I really get out of Puddleglum's speech in context with the series is him saying, well, Lady of the Green Kirtle, if you're right, if there is no sun, and this world you're looking at now is all that there is, well, then what's the point of anything? It's meaningless. It's boring. There's nothing here. I might as well live like a Narnian, even if there isn't any Narnia, because, well, then it's all pointless anyway. And so that's the way I personally have read it. And I think it'll be interesting to see which way they try to go with it.
Again, he's not saying that the truth doesn't matter or the reality doesn't matter. Uh-huh. What he's saying is, if this is the truth, if this is the truth, then this truth that you've presented to us is just as meaningless as the lie that I can come up with.
Yes. And I think that as I get the sense that as Puddle Glum is saying this, he knows the truth. As he's saying, this world is really all that there is. As he's saying it, he knows the real answer. He knows that, but that can't be true. How could I have this? How could I have just imagined all these amazing things if this little lamp was the only reference I had? Like, how could I just imagine the sun, or a cat, if a lion and this little lamp was the only reference I had for it? You know, I don't buy it. So I think he's sort of speaking the truth to himself, and he knows the answer himself as he's speaking it. So I think there's a lot of whoever they get, the actor they get for Puddle Glum, it's all going to be in the performance. I think is like how exactly do you read what he's saying, and so there's going to be a very fine line to walk there. And by the way, a lot of this depends on, I think in the book, maybe this is, I know this might sound ridiculous, guys, comment if I'm alone in this, lost my train of thought completely. This is, I think, picturing the train and Inside Out collapsing. And it's on live. We can't edit this out. Darn it. Where was it going? Oh, yeah. Here's what it was. I really get into the sort of dreamlike state the characters are in when I read this in the book. And I start, not that I actually think, wow, maybe this is going to be a plot twist. And it turns out, oh, this whole world was imagined. There is no sun and there is no Aslan. No, I don't actually believe that. But I think it's easier to get into their heads of what's happening. And Lewis explains how it became hard to think and all that. And I think it's more difficult in a movie to get that across, because we're in a movie, we're not in their heads nearly as much. We're outside on the other side of a screen watching them say, maybe there is no sun. When they say that in the book, I at least kind of understand what's going on. And I don't think they're totally dumb or anything. I understand what's going on. So a lot of the power of Puddle Glum's speech, and so Puddle Glum's speech in the book, it really does on some level feel liberating when he says that, you know, because what Lady of the Green Kirtle was talking about was just so dark. So I think a lot of the success of Puddle Glum's speech depends on how well can they almost make you really identify with the characters as they're in this dreamlike state that we can't obviously really relate to in real life, but maybe for just like 10 minutes, maybe we can.
Right. It'll be a difficult scene to capture. I'd be curious, because I can think about how it's written. I mean, you've got a certain amount of dialogue there, but I wonder just how else that scene is written in the script and how it'll be visualized by the director.
Yeah.
And how it'll be portrayed by the actors.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of what'll make that scene work or not isn't even just the actor for Puddle Glum, because you can insert great performance.
Yeah.
your favorite pick for Puddle Glum, but then the Jill and Eustace, however they're playing their lines to set up that speech, that'll be key as well to sell the whole thing.
That whole climax, like talking about areas of the silver chair that might be difficult for film, it's sort of like, what's the real climax of the movie? Is it the destruction of the silver chair? Is it when they defeat the Lady of the Green Kirtle with the snake? Is it escaping from Underland? You know, like, what's the real? Is it more of the emotional climax of Aslan's Country at the end? I think a lot of the Narnia books kind of have these multiple endings that in film you kind of want to have that one moment where, boom, everything is resolved or the big climax. And I think we'll see. I predict that's what the whole, like, last from the moment they enter Underland is going to be reworked a lot. It might be a good thing. We'll see. But that's the thing we're going to be talking about the most, and that's going to be the thing the most divisive probably among fans.
Well, and to a certain extent, fortunately, the book doesn't. I mean, they say, I think fortunately, Lewis made his characters smart characters, as opposed to a lot of books where, it's kind of like you're watching the movie, don't go in the cabin in the woods, like, do you not know what'll happen?
Right.
They're at the Council of the Owls, and Eustace just says, I bet that snake and that witch are the same thing.
Yeah.
He's just, I bet they're the same person. Which is, of course, what the reader's thinking. And it's good that he gives you that, because then you realize, learning that the witch, that's not going to be the climax. That's not what this is about, because that's the audience is suspecting that all along, and the characters are suspecting that all along.
Yeah.
So that's not the climax. Learning that she, when she turns into the snake, is not supposed to be. Oh my goodness!
But like the fact that's when they defeat the villain, though. You know, so is that kind of the action climax, at least, of the story?
Right.
There's a comment from Gloria here, by the way, about saying that Paul Ogham's speech could be interpreted as, "If your view is true, then the view I have is a better one, and if there's a better view, it must be the true one." And that's one I just don't know about that. Now, there are plenty of fans that, in fact, probably most fans do kind of read it that way. So you're certainly not alone, Gloria. It's just me personally, I don't know if I would read it as simply as that. I don't think it's that it must be the true one just because it's better. Maybe I am kind of saying that. I don't know. It's not that it has to be true because it's better. It's that it's so good. How could I have made it up? There must be truth to this because it's way too good for me to make up. So I guess I would say I agree with you, Gloria, but I would want to kind of add, it's not that it's true because it's better.
Right.
It's true. It must be true because of just how good it is. It's not something I could make up. So, and that sounds very nitpicky, but I think it's an important distinction to make when they're doing the movie.
And also I would go back to, if we're talking about why the truth matters, if Glumpuddle's account is true.
If whose account, sorry?
If Glumpuddle.
If whose account, sorry?
Did it again. If Puddleglum's account is true, then what you believe has great consequences. And if he's not, then, why not be a nihilist? Why not live in a fantasy world of your own, of whatever one you choose?
Uh-huh.
If the witch's world is the only one offered, then it removes the significance.
Mm-hmm.
Someone else made a comment here. I don't remember who it was. Basically, some people, they espouse a certain version of things that has no, that they fight so hard for it. But then you ask, you're fighting so hard for something that you're claiming has no eternal consequences or no consequences that'll affect you beyond this life, which isn't what Lewis believed.
Right.
So I do think that along with the Emmeth situation. So I think it's very easy to misread, or the Susan leaving or forgetting and abandoning Narnia. I think a lot of those things are very easy to just gloss over and assign a one paragraph explanation.
And I think this is true for Narnia in general, actually. There's a lot of things about, I think that's one of the reasons why, as works of literature, I think Narnia doesn't get the credit it deserves, because people kind of see, they kind of get, I see Aslan is kind of a Christ figure here. And then they stop and they think that, that's it. And they walk away and they think they've just cracked the code and that's it.
That's why I love telling people, explaining to them that the Chronicles of Narnia is not an allegory.
Yeah.
If you read classic allegory like The Pilgrim's Progress or the play of Everyman, that's true allegory.
Yeah.
But this is not allegory. There's nothing in this that I could actually call allegory.
I think that a lot of the, like Puddleglum's speech and the whole example of Emeth in the last battle, those are two examples where if you just treat it that way, it seems like on the surface it's saying this. Maybe it's because people know that they're primarily written for children, that they're very quick to say, I got it, and walk away. But no, let's actually think through some of this. And it's actually much more nuanced and complicated and interesting than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, I think that's...
Well, how are you feeling?
How am I feeling about the silver chair? I think I'm feeling pretty good. I like the fact that, as far as we know, there's not a date they're trying to meet.
Not yet. It's not the time for that.
What's that?
It's not the time for that yet.
just as far as there's not... the script has to be ready by this date. They haven't set any dates for production or anything. As far as we know... They're right. Just, they're working on the script and they're going to wait until they're happy with it and then press forward, which is not too common these days in Hollywood films, especially. Even The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I would say, to a large extent. You get the feeling that they got the rights, they started moving forward with the movie, and then they hired screenwriters to say, okay, go turn this into, go turn this into a movie. They're sort of like the decision was made to move forward with the movie before they had actually knew if they had a good idea for the script, if they had a good idea for what this movie could be. So my hope is that
they're
taking all the time they need, you know, and they'll be like this and press forward.
Do you think that that's because I got the idea that Andrew Adamson was a little more involved with the script than maybe the typical director was? Do you think that's partly why?
He was more involved. He was pretty involved with the script. He actually did end up getting a screenwriting credit.
Right. See, that's what I'm saying.
It's a mix. I would say in terms of big Hollywood, like tentpole movies, that, you know, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe basically was, I would say, yeah, in terms of movies like that, he probably was a little more involved with the script than most directors are. Yeah. And Andrew Adamson, you know, and I have, you know, my opinion, Wardrobe and Caspian are both pretty good, but not great movies. But I do think he's someone where he wasn't just, you know, I took him somewhat seriously as an auteur and someone that wasn't just going to be the commercial director where he would just, okay, here's the movie you want. That's the product you want. I'll make that product. I think
he knew it wasn't the right decision. The fact that he wanted to skip Prince Caspian and go straight to The Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
He talked about it. I don't think he wanted to. He talked about it.
I think he kind of wished he could.
Yeah, I think a lot of people,
just because he loved that story so much, which says something about it. Like, well, I really love this story, but so I just don't know if I can, you know, last that long, you know. But I really am passionate about this one, and you know what? That's fine to say this script I'm really passionate about. This one I'm less passionate about. That means that you actually care about the writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, man, it's just awkward when this happens. You lose your train of thought live.
I'll say I feel pretty good. I mean, I'm feeling, I think, obviously, I'm going to be cautiously optimistic, and that's just me. I realize a lot of people are like, oh, yes, this is so cool. And I'm not saying that's bad or wrong. And this is just my own hang-up, being so cautiously optimistic. But that, I am optimistic. I am looking forward to this film. You know, there was a point where I think the last film I was cautiously pessimistic for. It got to the point for a good portion of it.
Right.
And here I'm getting to the point, yes, I'm actually getting to the giddy portion of fandom again.
Right. I would actually agree with you, probably not to the same extent that it, you know. And let's throw this out to the comments section, by the way. How are you feeling? Hey, let's just say on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 meaning I'm expecting the movie to be a disaster, and then 5 meaning I think it's going to be a masterpiece, awesome movie, awesome adaptation, and then 3 completely neutral, just like, I don't know, I think it'll be okay. Or you can just specify, I really have no idea. Bo, Gresham's confidence about the project gives me confidence. That's enough for Bo. I'd probably say a scale of 1 to 5. Yeah, I think really, and you're saying 4. I think I'm going to go ahead and say
4 down.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go ahead and say. I hate numbers, but it was my idea. I think I'll 4. Say.
2.
I'm going to say 3. I'm going to say 3.5. I Why am. Let me go ahead and make that official in the comment section here.
He's like, well, on a scale of 1 to 5,
my reasoning is
seven, scale of 1 to 10.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of. You know what? I'm gonna revise that. Let me post a comment here.
So James, is that 3.75?
Yes. Okay.
He said 3.1.
Yeah, because I am excited, but I'm wanting to see them prove themselves a little bit. Let's give me something concrete. Now, I guess there are some good signs, like the time they've taken with the script, and now revealing that.
We haven't really seen bad signs yet.
Yeah, I would say that. So you got Glorious completely neutral, 2.5 out of 5. I guess that's just complete neutrality, of just not knowing. There's definitely reason to hope. Absolutely. And Sarah, you're giving it a 4. There's definitely reason to hope that, because it's essentially a Narnia reboot. And I'm sorry to use that word. I know it's a very loaded word. I think this still will be in the same canon as the other movies. Maybe Liam Neeson will even come back to voice Aslan. I don't know. But reboot in the sense of fresh start, new creative team, new approach, new everything. We're not bound by the other movies at all. At least that's what it feels like. But I think there's a part of me that won't let myself get excited yet. Like super excited yet. But I'm very, very hopeful about the future, I would say.
Yep. I agree.
Okay, everybody. I guess if you're ready to log off, I guess I am here.
So yeah, super, I've got a little guy probably needs to be held.
Okay.
Oh, Bonnie is a six.
We have a six. Oh, man.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. She's already planning her – Bonnie's already planning her costume for the midnight showing for this one. You have to work here. Silver chair comes out in, oh, I don't know.
Bonnie, we hope that you've actually read the script. That'd be awesome.
That would be awesome.
Say you've read it.
I read the script. Six, guys. Trust me. That's basically what Gresham is saying. Gresham seems to be saying six.
Yeah,
so.
Basically. That's true.
Okay, well, thank you so much, everybody. This is something of an experiment with the live podcast. I hope we can do this again.
Here's the other thing. We were really hoping people would comment, so thank you, everyone who's commenting, and we really appreciate that because that's part of what we wanted with the going live.
Oh, James, thanks for giving the BBC audio dramas a shout-out. There's the focus on the family ones, which most people know about, but the BBC audio dramas are much more rare, and even I haven't heard all of them.
I have not heard of one.
Yeah, I've heard part of Don Shredder, I think. I've been wanting to get into the other ones. But anyway, so this Facebook Live thing was sort of an experiment. It seems to work decently well. If you guys have any comments or suggestions on it, let us know. But hopefully we'll get to do this again. I speculate, emphasizing that we'll get an announcement on a director for the Silver Chair. Now, in August, I said we should get one in the next few months, and now it's been a few months. I'll say it again. I think in the next 2 or 3 months here, we will get an announcement for a director for the Silver Chair, and I hope it's Spike Jonze is my official endorsement. I'm not saying it would be awesome if Spike Jonze directed an Arnie movie. I'm saying it might be. It would be weird. It would be interesting to see what a director like that would do with it, and I want to see them really roll the dice on someone rather than just grab the guy who directed Divergent, whoever that was.
Oh, please.
Anyway, sorry.
All right.
All right. Thanks so much, guys. Further up and further in.